My name is Christian Ashley, a seminary student and servant of God, and you are listening to the Let Nothing Move You podcast, a proud Anazal Ministries podcast.
Welcome back, everyone, to the next episode of the Let Nothing Move You podcast. I'm your host, Christian Ashley, as we continue on through the book of Matthew. Today, we're going to be in Matthew 8. But before we head that way, I do need to give some just announcements real quick. I'm not in the best mood. To be perfectly honest, for multiple factors, we unfortunately have lost another family member on my dad's side of the family, back-to-back deaths. One of them, I mean, I don't know if you can use the word better, but expected given age and health and everything, but that doesn't make the loss any less difficult to wrestle with. And so please continue to be praying for my family. We really do appreciate it. As well, I had a conversation with a friend last night when I was originally going to be recording this, but after that conversation, I just didn't have the heart for it because they told me something that had happened to them, and it's not my place to say exactly what happened, but it kind of put me in the wrong mind spot. I didn't want to record like that. So I do feel a little better, you know, post learning that information, but it's still something that prayers are needed for. And I would say more if I were allowed to, but out of respect for the situation and the person involved, just be praying. I know non-specifically isn't my favorite thing to do in prayers, but sometimes it's what we need to do. So thank you guys again for all that you do. It really is a huge encouragement to me as we go through this life together, that we are praying for each other. We're looking out for each other. We're asking for God's will to be done. And that's something I've had to remind myself, is just because the events that are happening around me isn't something that I want, it doesn't mean that God isn't in control. It means that despite humanity's sin, God is still in control and working around our sin to bring glory to his name. And yeah, so without any further ado, let's just get into this. So we're going to be starting today in Matthew 8, verses 1 through 4. When he came down from the mountain, great crowds followed him. And behold, a leper came to him and knelt before him, saying, "Lord, if you will, you can make me clean." And Jesus stretched out his hand and touched him, saying, "I will, be clean." And immediately his leprosy was cleansed. And Jesus said to him, "See that you say nothing to anyone, but go, show yourself to the priest, and offer the gift that Moses commanded for a proof to them." So we've talked before multiple times on leprosy and how it's a multifaceted term for separate medical conditions that can occur in the human body as a result of bacteria, fungal infections, and so on and so forth, that essentially cause a person to have to be sent out of society for the sake of everyone else so that the disease doesn't spread. And we've covered the laws in Leviticus and beyond in the Pentateuch that, you know, discuss how someone is supposed to be treated in this, how they're not supposed to be ostracized, but they're supposed to still be taken care of. But at that same time, that person is willingly supposed to stay away from everyone else for the sake of the community. And what we have here is a very bold person. And we're going to see some bold people in this chapter. And I think that's one thing that Matthew is tying together here, is showing the boldness and the faith of people and how they show themselves before Jesus. And this leper is a bold man. He's a faithful man, someone who seems to have actually been paying attention when he could still be in the synagogue. And upon hearing Jesus' words and hearing the story of who he is, what does he do? He says, "Lord, make me better." No, he says, "Lord, if you will, you can make me clean." Now, there's nothing inherently wrong with someone going up to Jesus and saying, "Lord, I have this affliction, please heal me." But there's something amazing about someone who shouldn't be doing this according to the customs of the time, not the law, but according to the customs of the time, going up to a man that he rightfully calls Lord and asking him if he wants him to do it, he could be clean again. And Jesus responds to him well because he sees this man's faith. He says, "I will, be clean." and there wasn't any big reveal. It just happens. Because this is Jesus showcasing his mastery over nature and showcasing his mastery over humanity. And this man is someone we should look to in how we approach Jesus, in how we approach Jesus in prayer, in how we approach Jesus in just talking to him. Lord, I desire this, but more than that, I want your will to be done. The man doesn't demand to be healed. It would be great for him to be healed. He wants to be healed. It is not good to be afflicted by disease in any way, shape, or form. But does the man make it about him? No. He makes it about Jesus Christ standing in front of him, and he says, Lord, if you will, you can make me clean. So sometimes that means when we ask Jesus something, when we ask God something, the answer is going to be no, because it's not what he wills. And we don't have to understand it. We don't have to like it, but we have to submit to it. Jesus could have said to this man, no, I don't will. Go away. And he would have been perfectly righteous to do so. Just God is righteous to do so to all the prayers that are sent his way for things that run contrary to his will, but they're said in prayer by people who are earnestly asking for something good. But in this circumstance, Jesus wills it, and the man is healed. And then what does he do? He cautions him. Don't tell anyone what happened. Just go and do as you're commanded. Why? Because those laws are still in effect right now, because Jesus hasn't died on the cross. So as a sign of good faith, as a sign of Jesus acknowledging the law as something that was given directly by God, he sends the man that way, but also to serve the purpose of not making it about the miracle, which is how people would wrongly take this. And instead, it's made about this man being healed, which is a miracle, but they don't know the source, so they should know the source is God, because this man, they have seen him for however long he's been around as a leper and go, wait, that doesn't just happen. So the Jewish priest should be praising God's name because he's right there. But Jesus knows their hearts. And it's also a test for them. This man has been tested and he's not been found wanting. This man has been found righteous. But we don't see a follow-up here about the Jewish leaders asking questions because their hearts were hard. Because this was routine. This was something they had to do. And that's a very dangerous place to be in, especially as a Christian. Of a moment where we have witnessed something miraculous in front of us. We've seen people get healed. We've seen relationships get restored that had no business being restored by a human way of looking at things. We go, okay, that's great. And we move on. It's like, no, that's a terrible way to respond to these things. We should be praising his name when these good things happen, because they weren't wholly done with human hands. They were done with God directing people to where they needed to be. But we just sit in church and we listen to the message and we move on. It's like, fine, whatever, Jesus. Yeah, good job. Yeah, someone got healed. Yep, the cancer was removed. Oh, that's great, Jesus. And it doesn't do anything to us. And living in that stagnant pool of, what's what I'm looking for here, just complacency and mediocrity is a terrible way to live the Christian faith. So I want to look at this man, and I'm going to look at the man we're about to meet in the next verses and see how do they respond to these things. And how do people not respond well to these things? And how we should judge ourselves and go, okay, how did I respond the last time I heard something miraculous that happened when something good happened to someone else? I'm not saying that to like beat you guys down or anything like that, but I'm saying it as like an honest call to also myself. How do I respond when those things happen? Am I overjoyed? Am I like, whatever? Do I say, man, that's great, and then I move on with my life? Like, how do we respond to Jesus and his works? Let's think about that as we continue on through verses 5 through 13. When he entered Capernaum, a centurion came forward to him, appealing to him, Lord, my servant is lying paralyzed at home, suffering terribly. And he said to him, I will come and heal him. But the centurion replied, Lord, I... Sorry, I'm becoming a man. Thanks, God. I needed that one. Let me try that again. Now that I'm fully a man. Lord, I am not worthy to have you come under my roof, but only say the word and my servant will be healed. For I too am a man under authority with soldiers under me. And I say to one, go, and he goes, and to another, come, and he comes. And to my servant, do this, and he does it. When Jesus heard this, he marveled and said to those who followed him, truly I tell you, with no one in Israel have I found such faith. I tell you, many will come from east and west and recline at table with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven, while the sons of the kingdom will be thrown into the outer darkness. In that place there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. And to the centurion Jesus said, go, let it be done for you as you have believed. And the servant was healed at that very moment. This is one of the most astonishing stories we hear in Scripture, because it destroys the status quo of the Jewish people at the time. This is antithetical to everything that they believed, because how dare Jesus say what he says here? We're children of Abraham. We deserve everything that God is going to give us. Forget these faithless Gentiles. How could you call him more faithful than anyone else in Israel? Well, because he's acting faithfully. Because he's doing what he's supposed to be doing. He's responding to Jesus. And this man, this centurion, he doesn't get a name, but he's a member of the kingdom because he shows his faith. And this is twisting expectations, because this is unexpected. And Jesus is always doing the unexpected, because we are fools who can't think like he does all the time, who want things done our way. And to the Jewish people at this time, this makes no sense, because they didn't study the scriptures well. And just through the Pentateuch alone, how many times have we talked about the Gentiles coming to faith? We haven't even gotten to the prophets. We haven't even got to the historical narratives where other people of different races and different countries come to faith in God. And it shouldn't be unexpected. If they had actually studied these books well and then understood what they were saying, this should be, oh, this makes perfect sense. The Gentiles are coming in too. It's finally time. But no, instead, this is flipping the expectations of the people, who are going to be very angry at hearing stuff like this, because it runs counter to how they think and what they want. They want just the Jewish people to be saved, because they are selfishly thinking only of themselves, when God has said he wants to redeem the world to all those who would say yes to him. And this centurion, this is a man we should be like. This is a man who knows faith, who knows how to approach Jesus Christ. What does he say? For I too am a man under authority. And before that, Lord, I am not worthy. But only say the word and my servant will be healed. Because he understands. He is nothing. He commands these troops. He's a hot shot as far as everyone else compared around him. And yet he knows he's nothing. And he comes to Jesus as a man who is nothing and becomes something, somebody. His servant. Not the servant of Caesar, the servant of Jesus Christ. Because he recognizes true power. He recognizes true love, and he submits to that authority. And that's why Jesus responds the way he does. Because how many other people in Israel have approached Jesus like this? How many people has he talked to? Let's assume there's 100 people in every crowd that he preached to. Well, not a single one of them responded to Jesus this way. Yeah, there are people who responded in faith and became Christians and followed after Jesus. Yeah. But how many responded like this? Maybe they were, and they're just not covered. But using the biblical text only, I don't see it. The man from before, he responded in faith, but he didn't respond like this. Because you know why? That was to be expected. Jesus expected the Jewish people to submit to his authority because they should know better. They should know better than anyone else on the earth that he is Lord. So there's an expectation of you just submit to me and do what I tell you to do because you should be already doing that. It shouldn't be notable. It's not newsworthy for a Jewish person at this time to come to faith. Because that should be the expectation. Just as much as I don't make it a news story, or no one else should make it a news story out of every time that I hold the door for a little old woman so she can get inside a building. It's expected of me to look after other people and make sure that they have an easier time of things. But their expectations and God's expectations were two separate things. Imagine that. So God doing the unexpected brings in the Gentiles like he does with the commander, with the centurion. Because the people who were supposed to be doing what they were doing weren't doing what they were supposed to be doing. So the supposedly faithless Gentile comes into the fold, becomes a sheep under the command of the good shepherd. And unfortunately, the same people who had the expectation that simply because I'm Jewish, I'm getting in. Jesus talks directly against them. And yet, specifically here, he's talking about the Jewish people. You can easily say, throw the word Christian in there, who think that they're Christian, who go to church, who listen to the word every Sunday, sometimes Wednesdays too, maybe even Sunday nights, or maybe they listen to a favorite podcast of theirs. And yet they know nothing of him because they expect, well, I went to church, therefore I'm a Christian. Or, you know, my grandfather was a preacher, therefore I'm a Christian. Or I go on Easter and Christmas, you know, I'm a Christian. Or I just think positively about God, therefore I'm a Christian. And Jesus destroys that way of thinking, because if this is true, what he's saying, if this is true, let's throw that out there, that there is a hell, that there is an outer darkness, people that will be weeping and gnashing of teeth, then Jesus is loving to say these things. If it is not true, if everyone just gets in, regardless of the way you were, regardless of how you lived your life, Jesus is not loving to say what he does. This is a mental patient saying these things because they contradict everything else about him. It is unloving for Jesus to say these things if they're not true. But it is very loving if you know something bad is going to happen to then warn people about that. This is a cry against the Jewish people and anyone else who would proclaim themselves to be a child of God for living their lives incorrectly and thinking incorrectly. So what does that mean for us? It means we better be pretty dang sure that we know where we stand before him. Because I want to be like the centurion. I want to be like the leper. I want to go before Jesus and say, I have nothing to give. I have no power. I have no authority. I can't give you anything. But take me anyway, Lord. And for him to say yes. Because it's just that simple. And yet we complicate things needlessly because we want ourselves to be in power. Because what we want, we think to be better than what God thinks. Because we think we're too important for it. Or because we think it's a bunch of hogwash. And we want to live our lives the way we want to live our lives. Those are terrible ways to respond to a very simple request. I want to have a faith like this centurion. And I hope you do too. And if you don't think you're there, maybe do some honest self-reflection. Say, well, am I really saved? I'm not doing this to create an existential crisis or having a deep depression or anything like that. And if it does lead it that way, please let me know. I'm here to talk. But I am saying this is that we should do this at some point in time. There should be a moment in our lives where we seriously look at where we started and look at ourselves now and say, is this the life of someone who actually follows Jesus Christ, who is actually his, who isn't a fake, who isn't a forgery. But we bent down and we said, yes, Lord, not mine, my way, your way, your will be done. And eternally, we are secured in that. And let's also not forget the miracle here. Jesus wasn't physically there to heal this servant. Once again, showcasing his power over nature and humanity. Why? Because any other person, it's possible to do this miracle. Most of them, they'd probably have to go there. And God could even empower a prophet or someone else to heal someone from afar. But this is no big deal. It just happens because Jesus said it happens. Because who controls creation? The Lord of creation does. So in a moment, something that was an absolute is no longer an absolute. This absolute was that the servant was paralyzed and he is suffering terribly. And Jesus says, well, yeah, what? They were. Not anymore. And it just happens because he is Lord of creation. So when we approach that, our Father in heaven, we have to remember we're talking to someone who created everything and is in control of everything. And those absolutes that we see in our lives say there's no way that this war between Russia and Ukraine is ever going to end peacefully. Or this person is just suffering from addiction and drugs and alcohol, and there's no way they could ever change. Or this person is so set against Jesus Christ, as I knock over my drink. Sorry about that. This person is so against Jesus Christ, they're the atheist of atheists. They're never coming to faith. Maybe. But have you asked God to change it? Have you asked God to do a mighty work? Have you come to Jesus Christ and say, Lord, I don't see how this can happen, but I know you. And if you will it to be, it will be. This is not a powerless God who loves humanity. And it's like, man, I wish I could do something about you guys, but I used up all my power to create things. And eventually I'm going to bring you guys back. Like, no, this is the Almighty God, the self-sufficient God that we are talking to. And if he wills it, it will be done. So let us approach him in that manner. Lord, if you will, you can make me clean. Lord, if you will, you can heal my servant. Lord, if you will, you can help me in this financial crisis I'm in. You can help me restore my family. You can do all these things that are impossible to me. Because if you will it, it will be done. There is nothing that can get in the way. So let us approach Jesus correctly. Let us also move forward to verses 14 through 17. And when Jesus entered Peter's house, he saw his mother-in-law lying sick with a fever. He touched her hand, and the fever left her, and she rose and began to serve him. That evening, they brought to him many who were oppressed by demons, and he cast out the spirits with a word and healed all who were sick. This was to fulfill what was spoken by the prophet Isaiah. He took our illnesses and bore our diseases. And hits keep on hitting. There's plenty of people who need Jesus' help. And you think this is some coincidence? You think it just happened to happen this way? No. All these things God allowed so that his glory could be brought into the world. In a world filled with sin, filled with suffering, God allowed the sin and suffering to happen so that when Jesus shows up on the scene and overturns those things, it should point people to him and have them respond well and go, wait, this is the status quo. You're destroying the status quo. I want to be with you, Jesus. And so it brings people who need help, like the people who are afflicted, being oppressed by demons, the oppressed being different from possession. It could be both in, or either or in the situation. We've talked about the differences before. In this one, it is with both because he casts them out. And he heals people who are sick, including Peter's mother-in-law. Now, as far as I'm aware, she doesn't get brought up a lot, except for maybe another one of the Gospels. Or maybe it's the Synoptic. I can't remember off the top of my head. But hey, by the way, Peter's married. Kind of just thrown in there. Not really focused on. Does that mean that he left his wife behind to go serve with Jesus? Does this mean that, let's see, that he's a widower and he's still looking after his mother-in-law? We don't know. We can speculate all day long, and you can mischaracterize Peter all you want, positively or negatively. But at the end of the day, we simply don't know. But what we do know is that Peter loved his mother-in-law enough that he asked Jesus for help. Well, no, actually, no, that he brings Jesus to his mother-in-law, and Jesus sees what happens, and he takes care of the issue, which actually shows an issue with Peter. I mischaracterized him myself. Sorry about that. And that Peter, as far as we see in the text, does not ask Jesus for help. Jesus just responds to an issue. Now, whether that's because Peter didn't know, and he showed up on the scene and said, oh, no, my mother-in-law's sick. Or if he did know and he just didn't have the faith to speak up and used whatever ways it took to Jesus get Jesus to his house that she would be healed, we don't know. Let's not focus on that. But what we can focus on is that there was a woman lying sick with a fever, and it was gone because Jesus commanded it to leave. And what does she do? It's like, oh, well, I've been through something traumatic. I'm done. No, she gets up and serves, helps people. Realizes that she has been given much, so let me go and give much in return to others. And I could go on a diatribe about, you know, Peter being married and, of course, being the first Catholic pope and the Catholic tradition and all that mess. That's a rabbit trail I'm not going to go down on. It's something to consider. But, I mean, I didn't do too much research on it because I didn't care enough, to be perfectly honest, but I do know that people have discussed it before, and that's something to be brought up here, but Peter was married. The context of that, we don't know, so just deal with it. And we'll go from there to verses 18 through 22. Now, when Jesus saw a crowd around him, he gave orders to go over to the other side. And a scribe came up to him and said to him, Teacher, I will follow you wherever you go. And Jesus said to him, Foxes have holes and birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. Another of the disciples said to him, Lord, let me first go and bury my father. And Jesus said to him, Follow me and leave the dead to bury their own dead. That's it. That callous Jesus, he doesn't care about where people are at. Like someone says, Lord, I'm coming. It's like, you can't even live with me. Oh, Lord, let me just steal my father, bury my father, and I'll come serve you. It's like, the dead will bury their own dead. It's like, let's look at the context here, people. Do you think that's how Jesus is going to respond to these people? Or do you think that Jesus, being Jesus, knows their hearts and calls them out on who they are? This scribe says, Teacher, I will follow you wherever you go. Notice it is teacher, not Lord. He sees Jesus's wisdom and wants to emulate that and wants to be like that, but he does not recognize Jesus as Lord because this man has grown up in a time where you go under the greatest rabbi around you and that will uplift you in society. And then suddenly you're going to be the top dog one day. That's the expectation. But Jesus refuses him, telling him, I'm calling you out. My disciples, these people that you wouldn't even look at, they can live in the wilderness. We don't have a home. We travel from place to place. Our finances are not the greatest in the world. Can you live that way? The answer is no, so get out. You have no business being here because your heart isn't in the right place. And another person who would claim to be in the disciples, as far as disciples outside of the 12 that were following after Jesus, Lord, let me go. First go and bury my father. Well, he calls him Lord, so that means he has to understand who Jesus is, right? No, because if he understood who Jesus was, yeah, he correctly uses the word Lord, but that doesn't mean anything based on what else he says, because his heart isn't in the right place. This is not Jesus saying it's not important to bury your own dead. Yes, bury your own dead, but don't use them as an excuse to stay away from me. Because when Jesus shows up around, hey, your father's buried, you're going to come hang out with us now? You're going to listen to my teaching? How there's always going to be another excuse for someone like that. And so he doesn't bother with them. He tells them truth. Like, look, get rid of those things that are going to keep you from me, all those excuses, and follow me. This is not Jesus saying that he doesn't want people to follow him. This is not Jesus saying that it's not important to have funerals and look after the lost and help people grieve. This is Jesus saying, quit using these excuses to stay away from me. You know better. I know better. So follow me. And judging by the lack of responses here from those two men, it doesn't seem like they followed him. And I don't know about the rest of their lives, but given how the text is handling them, I imagine they're going to be in the number who are going to be thinking they're part of the team and ending up weeping and gnashing in the realm of weeping and gnashing of teeth. And that's not pleasant. I don't like that. But you got to judge people by how they act and how they perform and what they say and do. And these people know nothing of Jesus. And I hope and pray that along the way in their lives, they did come and find him and they did get saved. But without any textual basis for it, I can't make that argument. Now, I think there's a stronger bit of evidence to say that they never did, given how they react. And we'll go from there to verses 23 through 27. And when he got into the boat, his disciples followed him. And behold, there arose a great storm on the sea, so that the boat was being swamped by the waves, but he was asleep. And they went and woke him, saying, save us, Lord, we are perishing. And he said to them, why are you afraid, O you of little faith? Then he rose and rebuked the winds and the sea, and there was a great calm. And the men marveled, saying, what sort of man is this, that even winds and sea obey him? You see how a lot of this chapter is kind of revolving around the concept of how people respond to Jesus. And as well as the theme of expected versus unexpected. So would you not expect that the very people who are around Jesus 24/7, would you not expect them to know better? To respond more positively? To not live in fear? To not live in anxiety and anguish? And to go, well, there's a storm happening right now. But is there any better place in the world to be than besides Jesus? That would be the expectation, right? Well, that'd be the expectation if they understood who Jesus was. And unfortunately, at this part in the disciples' faith, they're not there yet. Yeah, they've responded. Yeah, they listen to him. They even call him Lord. But I am willing to bet. As I knock down my microphone and have to reset it, my bad again. I'm just having a day. I'm willing to bet. I can't prove 100%, but I'm willing to bet that they don't know who Jesus is truly until after the resurrection. Because the 12 disciples, they're beside him every day. They're hearing everything he's saying. But if you look at what they say, if you see how they react to the things that Jesus says throughout the Gospels, it is easy for me to say they're not there yet. And you say, how is that possible? They're right next to Jesus. How could the people closest to Jesus not be believers? Well, because people can be fools, thinking that they're wise. And look, there is no better place. I want these men. I'm spiritually jealous of them. How can I not want to be right beside Jesus? But they don't get it. And let us not forget who's among the 12 right now. Judas, the one who's going to betray Jesus, the one who lets Satan inhabit his heart. You're telling me that man, 3 years with Jesus, and he doesn't come to faith? Yes. Because of self-delusion, because of pride, because of it not being their time yet. So the disciples don't get it yet. They'll say some right things every now and then, and that's good. That's wise. But it doesn't mean that they are fully wise. It does not mean that they are fully saved. It means they've been around a person who knows the answers. And just because you're around someone who knows the answers doesn't make you as intelligent and wise as they are. And so this storm should be nothing to them. They have seen everything that has happened in this chapter and the things that happened before that. So yeah, sure, a storm's a little bit different. At Sea of Galilee, it's a very terrifying place to be in the rickety, rackety boats that they had back in the day. And these storms would just come up out of nowhere, and you couldn't prepare for them. You just had to hope for the best, pray to God. Well, didn't they have to pray to God? They were right with God. If they understood that, if they understood who they were dealing with and what he actually was, but they don't get it yet. And that's why the fear and the anxiety and the hopelessness comes in. And Jesus calls them out on it. Why are you afraid, O you of little faith? You don't say that to someone unless they're lacking faith. And the disciples at this point in time lacked faith. Because just like Jesus could heal from afar, he could stop the storm instantly. And you also know why I think the disciples weren't saved? Because of how they questioned him. They marveled, saying, "What sort of man is this that even winds and sea obey him? Does that sound like someone who's a true follower of Jesus? Who understands that he is Lord over earth, over heaven, over all creation? The one that saved them from themselves?" Well, it doesn't to me. Sounds like people who just aren't there yet. And that's okay. At that moment, we're all in different parts of the walk. And there may be someone listening right now who's questioning things, who's almost there, who wants to understand who Jesus is a little better, but you don't get it yet. I welcome you here. There's no better place I wish you would be than listening to truth. But we have to respond to that truth at some point in time. And the disciples eventually respond well to truth. So let us go and do the same. These things should move us. These aren't just stories. If these are fables, if these are historically inaccurate, these stories are worthless. All the events that happen, this guy named Jesus, yeah, he sounds cool. But if they're not true, these are worthless to us. Because truth isn't being presented. Because it's a fabrication. Because this can't save me from myself. This can't improve me eternally. Yeah, sure. There are plenty of self-help books out there. There's plenty of religions and cults and philosophies or whatever you could join and believe in. You want to be a Stoic? Be a Stoic. You want to be a Mormon? Be a Mormon. You know, be a Buddhist, be a Buddhist. But all that does is just tickle our ears. All it does is just make us feel good. This book makes me feel good and then makes me do something about that. Because I see truth and I want others to experience that truth. So let us go out there and bring truth to the world. Because I don't want to be scared when the storm is around. I want to know that I'm secure and I have an eternal security. My faith, my salvation can't be taken away from me. You can argue all day long against that notion, but I see no biblical truth for it. One and done, baby. That's my Jesus. Should be our Jesus. We'll finish off today by reading through verses 28 through 34. And when he came to the other side, to the country of the Gadarenes, two demon-possessed men met him, coming out of the tombs, so fierce that no one could pass that way. And behold, they cried out, "What have you done to us? What have you to do with us, O Son of God? Have you come here to torment us before the time?" Now a herd of many pigs was feeding at some distance from them. And the demons begged him, saying, "If you cast us out, send us away into the herd of pigs." And he said to them, "Go." So they came out and went to the pigs, and behold, the whole herd rushed down a steep bank into the sea and drowned in the waters. The herdsmen fled, and going into the city, they told everything, especially what had happened to the demon-possessed men. And behold, all the city came out to meet Jesus, and when they saw him, they begged him to leave their region. I want to talk about some unexpected things. Do you expect, when you hear about demons, do you expect them to talk to Jesus in this manner? Or do you expect them to be the more Hollywood, conniving, sniveling? It's like, "Oh, well, the Son of God, we're so much better than you. We can overcome everything." Yeah, you see in a ton of media these days, demons have so much more power over the world, and they don't fear God at all. Well, if you actually look at the text, these jokers are terrified. Because, like the centurion, they saw true power, but unlike the centurion, they refused to submit to it. They asked for an extension. They asked for help to get away because they saw true power in front of them, grew terrified, and then begged not to be cast down into hell again. They begged to be put in some pigs instead. "Look, okay, yeah, human beings, Lord, made in your image. That's great. Also, these things, these lesser beings here, throw us there instead. So sorry, man." Because they'd rather do that and live in the body of a pig possessing them than submit to the Lord that was right in front of them. Because they know their end too, by the way. They know that the time is coming when Jesus will come and upend everything in this world and remake heaven and earth in his image, saving creation from itself to all those who are his. And they're going to be punished. Do you think if they're going to make it at the end, that they're going to be there in a new heaven, new earth, that they're going to act in this manner? No, because they're terrified. They know their end, and yet they still resist. Because resisting means they don't have to say, "Yes, Lord." They can say, "No, Lord," and do whatever they want until the time. And it's that foolishness that we see in these demons that we see in plenty of people around us who know better, who have been raised in a church well, who have been taught truth and then said, "Not my truth. My truth means this. My truth means I don't have to say, 'Yes, Lord.' My truth says, whatever, Jesus, I don't care about what I have to say. I'll be a good person. I can do this." Or maybe they're even honest and say, "I don't even need to be a good person. I can do whatever I want." And despite knowing the end, knowing truth because it has been taught properly to them, they respond with evil. They respond with apathy. They respond with, "Jesus, you can take care of your own, but I'm going to do my own thing." If you're even real to begin with. But even these demons don't even question Jesus' existence. They go, "Hey, Son of God, have you come to torment us before the time? Just send us to the pigs instead." And then how do the people react? In fear. Because they see something that couldn't be done, these people being taken and freed from demonic possession, and as pigs instead being taken down into the waters, and they fear for themselves, they fear for their livelihoods, and out of pride, they say no to the Son of God. They beg him to leave because they know what it means, that someone like him has power over what they were powerless to stop, and they refused to submit. I would say to all of us, let us not be like them. Let us go out in truth. Let us respond well to truth and accept him alone as our Savior. Thank you guys for all you do. Please leave a 5-star review on your podcasting platform of choice to help us with the ratings there, to help us find more people. Please feel free to share the show with your friends and family members. If you're interested in my own fiction writing, you can find my works at starbrandedskill.com or on Amazon by searching for the name MC Ashley. If you're all interested in some fairly solid studies into the Bible and its teachings, then check out the other members of the Anazal Ministries podcasting network. You can find me specifically on Systematic Ecology, Why I Don't Like, Friday Night Frights, and Some Joyful Noises. Contact me at letnothingmoviepodcast@gmail.com. I'd like to extend a special thank you to Joshua Noel for the editing that he does and for the music he adds to the podcast. And with all that in mind, God bless you all in accordance to his will and not mine. And allow me one more time to remind you, let nothing move you.